For the week of June 5th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 106, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at Yankee Stadium, waiting for Derek Jeter to get his 3,000th hit, I'm Michael Giltz.
He still hasn't gotten his 3,000th hit yet?
He's got like 14, 15 to go. I'm hoping he'll get on a tear and do it while he's at Yankee Stadium, but it's not looking good.
Well, if he gets 3 to 2 hits per game on average, yeah, he could pull it off.
Yeah, he's not getting one hit per game, so it's not looking good.
But of course, this is not a sports podcast. It is, in fact, an entertainment podcast.
And on today, why did I watch college rugby all weekend long?
I have absolutely no idea.
And we're not going to talk about Federer and Nadal at the French Open?
I don't think that's on the agenda, in fact.
All right.
But we will be talking a lot about the music business and theater. And on today's show, we will actually be joined by Brian Scott Lipton, the editor-in-chief of TheaterMania.com, which is the premier website for news, reviews, and info covering the theater world in New York City and major cities across the country. He'll be discussing the top shows of the season and what to look forward to this summer and fall. And of course, who's going to win big on the Tony Awards this Sunday? Billboard magazine isn't sure whether it wants to compete with Rolling Stone or Us Weekly. We'll look at the changing face of the venerable magazine's website and music. For Inside Baseball, we'll cover the continued seismic effect that ebooks are having on the publishing industry. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the weekend's box office this week will be North American box office because I don't have a lot of the worldwide figures, but it's quite similar. In the U.S., I should say the North America, because this also includes Canada, the number one film at the box office was X-Men First Class, which grossed $56 million in its opening weekend. That's the lowest opening weekend for any film so far in the X-Men franchise, but the movie did get good reviews. At number two is The Hangover Part 2, which grossed $32 million. It's at $186 million total in North America. At number three is Kung Fu Panda 2, which I was kind of hoping would hold better, but it's at $24 million, and it's just past the $100 million mark. At number four is Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides, another $18 million for that movie, which is about to pass $200 million in the U.S., And number five is Bridesmaid, still going strong, still at $12 million. That's past $100 million. That's at $107 million so far in North America. And number six is Thor, another Marvel property that grossed $4.2 million. It's at $169 million total in the U.S. And number seven is Fast Five, the most successful film in the Fast Five franchise from Universal.
The Fast and the Furious franchise.
The Fast and the Furious franchise. Yeah. It grossed $3.2 million in the U.S. It's now past $200 million. It's the first film released in North America to pass $200 million this year, though we'll be joined soon by Hangover 2 and Pirates of the Caribbean, among others. At number eight, Midnight in Paris, the Woody Allen film, which expanded wider to about 150 screens. That grossed $2.9 million, and that's at just under $7 million in the U.S. Everybody's raving about what a big hit this movie is, but it costs $30 million to make, so it's got quite a ways to go before it edges into profitability. At number nine is Jumping the Broom, which is at $35 million. At number 10, another wedding comedy, Something Borrowed, which grossed $36 million. Have there ever been three wedding movies in the box office top 10 at the same time? You've got Bridesmaids, Jumping the Broom, and Something Borrowed. And at number 11...
What about The Hangover? Well, I guess The Hangover isn't a...
It's not a wedding movie anymore,
yeah,
is it?
Yeah, I don't know. Probably not.
I mean, I didn't see it, so I don't actually know what the setup is. It's just a boys' night out in Bangkok, right?
I have no idea. I had no interest in seeing it.
I didn't either, especially after the reviews were so poorly. But it was a lot of people did have interest in going to the movies. The top five movies all grossed $10 million or more domestically, which is a very strong box office. As we mentioned, Fast Five passed the blockbuster total of $200 million. So that's a big, big hit. And X-Men First Class was sort of being sold as a success story because the studio did a really good job of lowering expectations. They kept saying, no, we don't expect this to gross more than $40, $45 million. No, we really don't. So when it grossed $55 million, people said, ooh, not bad. But in fact, it is the lowest opener for the franchise so far. It's kind of not a surprise because X-Men Wolverine was such a dog that even though it opened big to like, what was it, $86 million, that, the bad karma from that movie and the terrible reviews it and X-Men Last Stand had has sort of negatively impacted fans going to see this movie.
Yeah, I can't remember how much Wolverine made. I just remember how bad it was.
Right. It was a very bad movie. Though Hugh Jackman, I don't think it's a bit of a spoiler. I apologize, but he does have a quick cameo in this movie. It's very funny. It's probably one of the high points of the film. It was a very well cast movie. I really liked the look and the feel of it. It was sort of a 60s, 70s James Bond movie. Learned a lot of international locations, young cast, some really talented actors. I didn't find it very satisfying, but it does feel like a proper movie as opposed to Last Stand and Wolverine, which were very poorly received.
Well, a movie that looks to be positively received is Super 8, which opens on Friday. It is just getting the Twitter effect on this is going through the roof. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times I've seen people who have, you know, entertainment journalists who've seen the film saying they've loved it.
Yeah, no, it's gotten good early reviews from the industry. And it's got that Steven Spielberg gloss, and J.J. Abrams obviously is a hot property thanks to Lost on TV and his terrific rebooting of Star Trek in the theaters. So I'm looking very much forward to it. I can't wait to see it. It's going to open in some countries overseas. It's not a worldwide opening like we've seen with some big blockbuster films. It could have been, I think, but it's going out a little bit slower, which brings me to the worldwide box office. I want to talk about it for just a second. We didn't get the figures available in yet because we're recording early on Monday. But if you look at the top four that we have available from, you know, scattered reports here and there, the number one movie worldwide was X-Men First Class at $120 million. That includes the U.S. box office gross. And number two is The Hangover 2, which grossed $94 million worldwide, and it's at $338 million total. And The Hangover 2 actually beat X-Men First Class in a number of countries where they were going head-to-head. Pirates of the Caribbean grossed another $79 million total worldwide. It's at just under $800 million worldwide. It's really on a ferocious pace. And number four is Kung Fu Panda 2, which grossed $64 million worldwide. It's at $226 million total. You know, it's got a ways to go, but it's definitely a big step down from the $600 million that Kung Fu Panda 1 grossed. However, it does include a record opening weekend in China. Some reports put it at about $19 million. Other reports put it at $16.9 million. But they say it opened on 3,500 screens in China, and that's a pretty wide release in the U.S. And it set a record for its opening weekend in that country. And when you look at China overall, movies grossed $1.5 billion last year in China. And in a few years, it's expected to pass Japan to become the number one two market in the world for movies, which makes sense since there are a billion people there.
Well, so you're saying not the number one two. It's the number. It will be the number two market in the world for
after the U.S., after North America. Though I can't imagine North America in 10 or 15 years will still have that title. It doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't make sense. I'm actually writing a story right now for Box Office Magazine on this very topic. And China is just on a tear, as is Russia. Russia surpassed $1 billion in box office last year for the first time. And of course, in China, you have only 20 films coming into the country from outside, you know, from international territories. So 59% of the box office this year in 2011 has come from local productions inside China.
Yeah, so hopefully they'll open up a little bit more because there's money to be made. And it is sort of a, you know, capitalist economy, even though it's a socialist, a totalitarian government.
Well, they have this issue with the World Trade Organization. They have to comply by kind of lifting the quota or doing away with the quota for foreign films. But of course, all films will be released by the China Film Company, you know, so it's the China Film Group. They will release all the films. There's only one distributor per se in China.
And when we talk about worldwide box office, we're just pulling in whatever figures we can from Hollywood Reporter and the many websites and Variety and adding up the numbers. There is no really useful place where you can get a worldwide box office figure every week, including every country, every territory in the world. And of course, movies don't open in every country all around the world at the same time. X-Men First Class, for example, it's the number one movie worldwide, but it did not open in a lot of territories. It's not a huge wide opening. So it's got a fair amount of room to grow overseas. So that could really turn into a success story if it proves to have legs and continues to do well in countries where it opens.
Well, just to give you some example, it made $64 million over the weekend in its opening wherever it opened. So that's, you know, overseas, international territories, and domestically in North America, it made $56 million. So it made more money overseas than it did domestically.
Well, as one would expect. But again, that's not in a lot of territories. It has a lot of countries it hasn't opened in yet. So you can get into a huge, you know, they know once they can sort of predict how it will do in Brazil when it's opened already, in Mexico, and, you know, how it will do in France because it's already opened in Germany. More and more, you see more and more big releases like Pirates of the Caribbean, where it opens as wide as possible, as quickly as possible. But it is always a catch-as-catch-can, so you can't always look at a number and say, oh, it grossed $64 million. That's its, you know, wide release total top beginning. No, it could, you know, we know in North America, it opened at $56 million. It's not going to suddenly do better next week. It could do better next week in worldwide because it might open in more territories.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason that films don't open day and date with North America or worldwide is due to logistical reasons. I mean, you have to get the talent to different places for publicity campaigns. You have to do subtitling and you have to
make
go
prints.
Go through censorship in different countries. So on these big films like Pirates of the Caribbean, it makes sense. Everybody knows these films. Your marketing campaigns are pretty much done for you. So Transformers 3 will be released day and date worldwide. But films like X-Men First Class, where you might have to do a little bit more explaining and get through a few more censor boards, then they kind of stagger the release a bit.
Well, I don't know if that's the reason. I mean, this is the fifth film in a franchise. It's a pretty well-known property by now, isn't it?
I'm not sure why they didn't release that day and date worldwide. That's a good question, because that is something that they probably should have. Bridesmaids, or, you know, you can kind of understand, it's only open in the U.S. anyway.
Yeah, nobody knows what it is yet, and it will help worldwide to have been a big success in North America, so they can promote it in the England and other countries. Hey, the U.S. comedy hit.
Well, yeah, and sometimes, like with Thor, there was an Australian holiday, May Day and then Australia Day, and they wanted to take advantage of those holidays, so they opened up 2 weeks early in Australia before the U.S.
Can you tell us what distribution is like in India? We've talked a lot about China and Russia, and I'm not clear in my head what sort of good theater system they have in India. Do they have multiplexes? Is it well stocked with theaters and screens?
Well, much like Russia and much like China, and now Brazil as well, India is going through a multiplex boom. So they have a lot of single screens, which are either being retrofitted to be multiple screens or brand new multiplexes being built. So you're going from a standing start, you're basically increasing the number of screens in each of these territories. In fact, they're referred to as the BRIC territories: Brazil, Russia, India, and China. So India has its box office is definitely going up. They've got 1 billion people in the country. 250 million people speak English as their first language, and they see a lot of movies. So I would expect Russia, China, and India to become much larger box office powerhouses and maybe even surpass the United States in the next 5 years.
Well, BRIC, of course, is an economic term. It refers to those powerhouse countries that are, you know, rising in importance, both based on their population and their economies. Brazil, Russia, India, and China has political and social and economic ramifications. It's not a movie industry term as such.
No, not at all.
But right now, India, how much of a source of income is India? Do they have are there a lot of foreign movies that open and play and make money in India?
There are a lot of foreign films now that open over the past 3 to 5 years, yes. And you always ask me the one question I don't have an answer to each week.
I expect you to know everything.
You know, I know Russia, I know China, and I knew you were going to ask about India, and I should have looked that up beforehand. But I don't know off the top of my head how much what the box office is in India. I do know that they have started to open more and more films from Hollywood in India, although I still think it's only 20% of the box office.
Right. They're very dominated by their terrific local film industry.
Right. Correct. And keep in mind that ticket prices aren't as high in India as and some of these countries as well.
And Europe is basically akin to the U.S., especially Western Europe. It's a mature industry. There's a lot of multiplexes. It's pretty well stocked with good theaters.
Yes. I mean, the UK, France, Germany, Spain, they all went through their multiplex boom in the late 90s, early 2000s. Spain is a bit on the decline because they have a piracy problem, but you can see the UK, France, Germany, they're kind of increasing at a steady rate, much like the US, 2% per year, 2 to 5% per year. It's Eastern Europe, countries like the Czech Republic, I should say. That's where you see these wild swings of, you know, an increase in box office of 25%.
Hmm. And I hate to throw one that you might not know at you, but Brazil.
Brazil has about 2,500 screens in it, and the problem with Brazil is getting equipment and film into the country. They have lots of tariffs and like 100% tariffs on some of these things. So it's a big country with a huge population, and if they can figure out their tariff issue, They're building a lot of multiplexes. It really is a box office market on the rise. Same with Mexico.
It's the fifth largest country in the world. I think there's like almost 200 million people in Brazil.
Right. So you can see that if they could actually import some movies at a reasonable rate, then yeah, you could see that it could really go off the charts.
So suffice to say that the box office potential worldwide has huge amount of growth and upside to it. When you look at India and China and Russia and Brazil and Africa, which has no screens, very poorly screened right now, there's a huge upside for the movies that Hollywood is the best at making at.
Right. I mean, when you look at it, I think it was $31.2 billion last year in box office growth world, or box office take worldwide. $21.2 billion was international, and 10.6 was here in the United States and Canada. Only 30% comes from North America. The other 67% comes from overseas territories.
And that should be more like 10%.
Well, that's where it's headed.
So you're looking at a potential $100 billion worldwide film market, or $70, $80 billion easily.
I don't know. I'd have to see. I know that last year, the U.S. and Canadian box office did not grow at all, but the international box office grew by 13%.
Yeah. Well, there you go. So I think we've geeked out enough, but I did want to talk about worldwide box office and what it means and why we do it, and apologize for not having the figures available for more than the top four this week. But I blame Hollywood Reporter, because they've had a really good chart with international box office, and apparently for some reason they don't update it till Tuesdays, I guess. I guess the figures worldwide take longer to trickle in.
Now, Hollywood Reporter is owned by the same group that owns Billboard, which is a music trade publication, or it used to be a music trade publication. And you wanted to talk a little bit about the direction that Billboard has taken over the last year or two.
Well, we've discussed this a little bit before, but I thought I would hit it again. Basically, I've been overseas for a month, and I wanted to check up on the music charts and see where they were at. So I was looking at the singles and the album charts. And of course, I go to Billboard, a magazine I started buying when I was like 13 years old at my local record store. And number one on the singles chart is Adele, who's got her great song Rolling in the Deep, number one in the U.S., but she's been displaced on the album charts. The new number one album is, of course, Lady Gaga. At number two is Brad Paisley, a terrific country artist. At number three is Adele. At number four is a compilation from the TV show Glee. Then there's a hip-hop compilation. I didn't know what this was. I had to look it up. It's the Rick Ross record label Maybach. It's a compilation of all the artists that are on his record label. That's at number five. Mumford & Sons is still there at number 10. And you got a lot of oldies but goodies in the top 20 trying to gain attention, like Journey, the Beastie Boys, and my favorite, the boy band supergroup NKOTBSB, which is a merging of New Kids on the Block and the Backstreet Boys. And they're at number 7 with an album that combines some of their greatest hits and 3 new songs. So that's sort of some music news that I gathered by looking at the charts. But in looking at them, I, of course, went to Billboard.com, where I always go. And it just struck me again how bizarre their website is. This was a venerable trade publication. You know, this was the Bible of the industry. This is where you go. You're a record label executive. You work at a radio station. You're an artist. You're a manager. You're an agent. Whoever you are, you're a publisher. You would go to Billboard for smart, informed, intelligent news about the industry. It's still a multi-billion dollar industry. And yet, if you go to Billboard.com, all you get is a bunch of ridiculous junk. The big dominant stories on their website were as follows. 20 Musician Beach Bodies, which was a slideshow of artists in their bikinis at the beach. And most of the photos, frankly, dated from the early 2000s. I saw some from 2008, 2004. You know, it's not even like this summer's beach blanket bodies. Another big story was 20 Music Tweets of the Week, including one band, Best Coast, who said that Beyonce has the best hair weave in the world, and Rivers Cuomo letting us know that he's getting borderline too buff. The top 30 summer songs, a peg for a live Q&A with Nick Jonas, but because it's a live Q&A with questions from fans, it's sure to be sort of a gushing fan thing rather than an informed, intelligent discussion of Nick Jonas and his career and the Jonas Brothers and where they're at. A feature on Shaquille O'Neal, the basketball star, and his 10 best musical moments.
So basically, it's turned into more of a consumer-oriented website. And, you know, certainly the beach body photo gallery, things like that are meant to drive traffic. They are trying to drive page views and unique visits and drive up their search engine optimization so that every time you have a picture of Lil Wayne or of Justin Bieber, you can have one more hit on Google or Bing or any search engine that had, you know, for Justin Bieber.
But my question for you is, how badly are they damaging their brand? I mean, The Hollywood Reporter faced a similar dilemma, and what they seem to have decided to do was turn their print publication into more of a consumer-oriented magazine, like not like Us Weekly, but a publication with articles and features that mainstream people would read, while their website has remained sort of an informative place for people in the industry.
It's kind of their website is kind of like both. It's informative place for people in the industry and somewhat more consumer-oriented. It's this weird amalgam of both.
But Billboard to me is way, way over towards consumers.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
And I can't imagine any teenage girl is saying, oh, I have to go to Billboard.com to see their latest hot photos.
No. I mean, at this point, you've got Pitchfork Media and you've got Rolling Stone.
Well, People, Us Weekly. If you're looking for hot photos of stars, you don't go to Billboard.com.
Right. Well, technically, you just troll the internet and do searches, which is why all of these websites are posting such photo galleries in the first place.
But so am I crazy, or is Billboard destroying its brand, its name?
It might be destroying it in the industry, but I guess the folks who purchased, I guess it was Nielsen Media, they purchased Nielsen Media, which includes the Rolling Stone and it includes Billboard. Did I say Rolling Stone? It includes The Hollywood Reporter and it includes Billboard Magazine. They have taken a much more consumer-centric approach.
But that's not going to work. It's badly done consumer-centric. People are not flocking to Billboard to get a list of top 30 summer songs or see photos from 2004 of Justin Timberlake on the beach.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what their numbers are like. I haven't looked into that, but time will tell whether, if they fade away, then you're right.
All right. Well, do you think Amazon did a good job with their new approach?
I think they did a fantastic job with their new approach. You mentioned that Lady Gaga was the number one album of the past week. She sold 1.11 million copies in the first week of her, Born This Way. I bought the album. I still don't know the name. 1.1 million copies of that album. It's the highest or largest sales week since 2005, when 50 Cent's The Massacre sold 1.14 million copies. The thing that you mentioned about Amazon, they sold 440,000 copies of the album because they were selling it for 99 cents.
That's right. And one estimate we saw from Adweek is that they had to pay about $9 to the record label for every album they sold. And so this stunt cost them about $3 million. And the whole purpose of the stunt was to bring people to Amazon, bring traffic, and introduce them and get them to sign up to their cloud-based music service.
Yeah. I mean, they were going to do this with some artist. This was all about grabbing market share for their music service. As we record this show, Apple is announcing iCloud.
Didn't we cover that last week?
Well, we did, but they're actually literally, Steve Jobs is on stage right now as we speak.
So if you look at the $3 million as equivalent to an ad buy, maybe that's like two or three ads in prime time on television.
Well, a prime time ad can cost anywhere from like $300,000 to $700,000. So yeah, I mean, this is a smart marketing move for Amazon because yes, it's $3 million in an ad buy, but really they're getting way more value out of it. We're talking about it. It was in all of the newspapers, all these websites. Everybody's talking about this sale and Amazon.
But surely it would have been successful if they had properly handled the traffic. But if they're trying to convince you that their cloud service is the great, safe, secure way to go to listen to your music, having the site crash repeatedly does not encourage people to think they're trustworthy.
Well, I think all of these services will have these issues. Certainly, now that Amazon has gone through it once, they've learned and more than likely are better than most because they have gone through this.
Well, because they failed, they're now better?
Well, yeah, think about it.
How about if you don't fail in the first place? Surely that's the better convincing for customers.
Well, that of course, but that's going to happen to every single one of these services, Apple included.
So you don't think it's possible to maintain cloud-based services without failing and crashing sometimes?
Yes, I think that's absolutely correct. I think that you will always have issues with the service going out at some point.
So if you've got a business, you do not want to depend on that.
That is the big debate now, is just how much of the enterprise should move into the cloud and how much of it should remain behind an internal firewall. That is a subject for a tech podcast, though.
Right. But if Amazon's trying to convince consumers, hey, come to our cloud-based service, and they crash, to me, that's bad press.
Well, they got great press out of this.
But everybody reported how they kept crashing.
In the end, what they're reporting is 440,000 copies sold and that they had to pay $3 million for that opportunity. And yeah, I mean, they had some difficulties in the very beginning. And then they did repeated the sale on Thursday. So, and they had no problems whatsoever. So I think, you know, yeah, they had some, you know, a few bumps in the beginning, and they worked out the kinks, and now they're doing just fine.
All right. So that's how they're handling the new world. And we've seen a lot of artists adapting to, you know, digital sales and different ways of promoting their albums and their artists. We've got three acts, I think, if you include Lady Gaga, and to see how they're reacting to this new world. Tell us about the Kaiser Chiefs and Bjork.
Well, I found this fascinating. The Kaiser Chiefs, and when I read this, I thought, this is a brilliant idea. Now, they are a breakout Brit. Well, they broke out in 2005, but they're a British rock band that had released, I think, two or three albums. And they say they got tired of kind of going through the grind of touring and trying to promote these records. And, you know, they weren't complaining about it. They just said that they felt like they were touring more than they were recording and creating music. All of that marketing just burned them out. So what does the group do? They record their latest album, the name of which is now escaping me. Oh, it's...
The Future is Medieval.
Thank you. And they are selling it on their website for £7.50. So that's in British
money. About $10,
$11. Yeah. They have recorded 20 songs, and you can go in and choose the songs that you put on your digital album, create that digital album, create the artwork for it. So they give you all this kind of digital paraphernalia to create your own album cover. And then you get your own URL to send to friends and family and post on your Facebook page. And if anybody buys your album, the songs in, you know, the songs you've chosen in the order you've chosen to place them, then you will get £1, about $1.64 back into a private PayPal account, to your PayPal account.
So it's sort of a, like a, what do you call it? Like a Tupperware thing where, you know, they sell you the product and then you resell the product and they get a cut of that, those sales.
Yeah. It's like a multi-level marketing scheme. But in a way, what they're saying is we don't want to have to go tub thump for this album. We want our fans to go do that for us.
Well, that's a cute idea, but in my experience, isn't it true that when bands start their own record label, like the Kaiser Chiefs have done, obviously...
Actually, they're not on their own record label. They are. No, their record label is backing them on this.
They started their own record label.
It's
Chewing Gum Records.
Maybe for this, but it's a subsidiary of their record company.
So they're releasing this through their record, through the public record label?
Yes. And as a matter of fact, they say that if all goes well, that they may release a physical album in the fall that contains the top downloaded songs. So they will actually release a CD down the line.
But don't you find that when you try to do something like this, it's a lot more work than just, you know, doing something, maintaining this website and all these, you know, clever functions and features and all the processing of the information. I mean, this creates a lot of work.
It creates a lot of work, but you're also getting, we're talking about it. And when was the last time we talked about the Kaiser Chiefs?
It can't be your answer to everything, that we're talking about it and therefore it's successful. We can talk about the Titanic. That doesn't mean it's successful.
Right. I think you have to create these websites. I think at this point there are platforms that you can use to launch such websites. Certainly Cisco EOS, the entertainment operating system, was shut down by Cisco last week over the past month. But, I don't think it's as hard as one would think to do these.
It's not, but
things.
It's harder than just letting the record label do it. It's a lot more work when you're saying, all right, we're going to have this direct interaction with fans. We're going to create all this extra stuff. We're going to give you 20 tracks rather than 10. And then we're going to, you know, it seems a lot more complicated than just putting out an album. And by the way, I love Kaiser Chiefs. I mean, their first album, Employment, was terrific. Yours, True Angry Mob, was great. Off With Their Heads, great. I mean, all three of their albums have been in my best of the year list when they came out. So I'm really looking forward to checking this album out. I wish them well, but I think the idea that it's easier and simpler to do this massively complex new thing is the idea that this is somehow easier and takes the workload off them. I don't know about that.
Well, certainly they themselves aren't doing it. They're hiring people to do it, much the way Bjork has hired a bunch of artists to create, you know, an iPad app for her latest album, which is called Biophilia. And she's going to be releasing the album along with, and I guess 10 coordinated apps, one for each of the songs.
You get to download 10 apps when you buy her new album?
Correct, yes. And, you know, one of them is going to be directed by Michelle Gondry, who's directed some of her music videos in the past and is a filmmaker. He directed Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. And it's kind of an interesting way to, but all of these things are ways to gain fan involvement and build word of mouth and really take advantage of the technology that's available to them and to add a few extras.
Right. And so she's going to be performing some of it in Manchester in the summer. And then the album comes out maybe in the fall, I guess.
Yes.
All right. Well, she's a nutter. So I like her. So anything she does is interesting. So like one of the apps I saw is I'm not sure what the song is, but on the app you'll watch I think the song is called Virus. And if you download the app, you can watch a cell being attacked by a virus, you know, synced up to the music of the song. So I'm not sure how that works, but it sounds really cool.
Yeah, and of course, you know, Gorillaz, as you pointed out in the show notes, they did an iPad album.
That's right.
So, I mean, all of these things, again, it's a way to, different way to market, and people are thinking differently, which is kind of the nice thing.
That is. Though I bet after this album, Kaiser Chiefs say, well, you know what, let's just put out an album and tour.
Yeah, maybe we should just tour for 6 months. But, you know, they're keeping, you know, a lot more of the profits than...
Are they, if the record label's involved?
Oh, good point. I don't know. That is a good point. I don't know. They do have a record label.
Well, what makes you say they're not on a major label?
Well, I know they're, as I've been looking up, they're on Fiction Records, which, you're right, is a division of Universal Music Group, which is receiving part of the $100 to $150 million upfront payment by Apple.
Finally, I'm right. I've been wrong like 3 weeks in a row now. I'm so glad.
Well, we'll both be proven wrong a little later on during listener email.
I doubt it.
Well, before we're wrong about anything else, I guess maybe we should move on to theater news. And the Tony Awards are this Sunday, June 12th. So what better time to talk with writer and theater maven Brian Scott Lipton. He's the editor of TheaterMania.com, a premier website destination for news, reviews, and info on theater in New York City, across the country, and even overseas. Brian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
And Sperling. Well, first, Brian, before we dive into the Tony Awards, two shows have really dominated the news this season, obviously. One is The Book of Mormon, which is up for a ton of Tonys. And then there's Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, which gets its official opening on June 14th. These are the two big shows of the year, I feel like, as far as people outside the theater who maybe don't follow every in and out. Can Spider-Man turn itself around with the reviews coming on June 14th?
I mean, obviously none of my colleagues or I have seen it officially yet. Our press dates are later this week. But, you know, business was very strong. I mean, commercially business was strong even in the first incarnation. It's continued to be strong. So, you know, it could be hit no matter what any of us say about it.
So you haven't seen any incarnation of it?
No, I did not actually see Spider-Man 1.0, and I have yet to see Spider-Man 2.0. I'll be seeing it this week.
It seems like every time the cost of running the show week to week is reported, it gets increased. It started out at like 900,000, then it was 1 million, now it's 1.2 or 3 million, I think people claim. It's just every time it gets reported, people add on an extra $100,000 to it.
Well, they keep working on it, so it's certainly possible that they've added more things to up their running costs. And that is a lot of money to make every week, but it's certainly doable, especially in a theater the size of the Foxwoods, where if you sell it out, you can probably at least make your running costs back.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a $1.9 million a week potential gross. I think the show's grossing about $1.3 million a week now. So it's got a lot of room to grow, even though it's, you know, right up there towards the top as far as, you know, box office every week.
No, absolutely. Now, how that translates into making back a running cost that's now been, I mean, not a running cost, a capitalization that's now quoted to $75 million is a whole nother story.
And the interesting thing to me about The Book of Mormon is how uncontroversial the show has been. It's gotten great buzz and rave reviews from the first preview. It's a out-and-out smash hit. It looks like it's one of those once in a every 5 year or 10 year sort of monster hit that just runs and runs for a long time. I think that's the expectation. There's no upsetness or kerfuffle over the content of the show or the cursing or anything about it. Was this show's way paved by Avenue Q? Is that why people do not see the show as sort of edgy?
I don't know that people don't necessarily see it as edgy. What I think is that people don't see it as mean-spirited. And I think one of the things that has been brilliantly done by Trey Parker and Matt Stone and Robert Lopez and the entire creative team is, while they're certainly making their digs at the Mormon Church, it does not come off as mean or cruel in a juvenile way or in a nasty way. It seems a little bit more of an all-in-good-fun type of way, while making some very salient points. So I think that has a lot to do with it, and I think, you know, the fact that the Mormon Church itself hasn't really, you know, organized huge protests or talked that much about the show has helped as well, because they haven't chosen to feed any kind of controversy. And yes, I also do think we're just, in 2011, prepared for a wider variety of subject matters on stage or in television or film. Anything kind of goes these days.
Well, now, we were talking about money just a moment ago, and it looks like a very healthy season on Broadway, up nearly 6%. You have the long, usual running hits, of course, but also a lot of new shows that at least initially look like they're doing very well. If we go to theatermania.com and click on the Broadway grosses chart, we find 11 shows grossing $900,000 or more. How does this season overall look for someone such as yourself?
Critically, I think this was honestly one of the best seasons that I have sat through and been part of in the 20-something years that I've covered theater. There were more shows that really, really, really were worthwhile. And I think that's wonderful that also a lot of that has translated into business, that so many shows from War Horse to Sister Act to Anything Goes to The Mother with the Hat to even, you know, Jerusalem, a pretty tough play, have found substantial audiences.
Is that what they call it now, The Mother with a Hat? Because, of course, there's... There's a little.
Well, there are two ways of calling it, but that is the polite way of calling it. And there is a whole set of ad campaigns where that's all it's called, but the official title has not changed.
Well, of the new hits, which ones to you look like long-running successes, you know, ones that might have legs, and which ones may not last once the original cast leaves, like we're seeing with The Addams Family, which looks like it's having trouble now that Nathan Lane and Bebe Neuwirth are stepping away. So if you look at The Book of Mormon, is there any question that this show is in for the long haul?
Yes, I think it's absolutely in for the long haul, and as brilliant as this cast is, they were very wise not to have cast it with stars. So these people ultimately, you know, are, if not replaceable, you know, when new people do choose to come in, I don't, you know, provided they're just as good and there's no reason that they won't be, I think the quality of the show can maintain itself. It's not built around stars, and I think that was a lesson learned by something like The Producers, and now, of course, to a lesser extent by The Addams Family, both Nathan Lane, but when you're building shows that really people are coming to see the stars, you have to keep trying to find people who have the same value to consumers, and that's not easy. I don't know that How to Succeed will continue on this big a winning streak when Daniel Radcliffe leaves.
Daniel Radcliffe, of course, being the actor who portrayed Harry Potter in the Harry Potter movies. Now, last year when we had you on the show, we talked about how there was, an onslaught of A-list Hollywood talent moving to Broadway for numerous reasons. And this year there's been some talk about a Broadway backlash against Hollywood stars. And of course, there's actors like Daniel Radcliffe, as we just mentioned, Al Pacino, Scarlett Johansson, Ben Stiller, and Chris Rock in the Mother with a Hat. And these are all just recent. Do you really think that there is this backlash of against Hollywood big names?
No, I don't honestly believe that there's any kind of backlash. I know people have talked about that because of some of the bigger names like Daniel Radcliffe and Chris Rock not getting Tony Award nominations, but I really don't believe that the Tony nominating committee was in any way sending a message or, and I have not spoken to them, or concerned about that. I think in each case they chose the five actors that they thought were most worthy for the nomination in a very, very competitive season. And if some of those people got left out, I think that really was just a question of how they felt about those performances.
Yeah, I agree with you completely, Brian. I mean, if you look at all the names of people that were nominated, you see a lot of famous people like Edie Falco, Judith Light, yeah, Ellen Barkin, Vanessa Redgrave, John Larroquette, Al Pacino, Frances McDormand, and a lot of them have theater background, but they're also clearly big stars. So the idea that it's a backlash seems silly to me.
Yes, I think that was just an overreaction to Daniel being, you know, omitted from that category, which was an extremely competitive category.
It was, and I think if there were six nominees, he probably would have been beaten out anyway by Aaron Tveit for Catch Me If You Can. But we're talking about the Tony Awards now when we talk about categories. So tell us, who do you predict will win Best Musical?
You're starting with the big boys then. You're going right to the main categories.
I do think, of course, that's Book of Mormon. It is sort of the unstoppable force this year. And it's, you know, it's a good group of shows. I mean, certainly in any other year, I think both the Scott of Our Boys, admittedly now closed, would have had a great shot. And Sister Act, I think, is a big crowd pleaser and a wonderfully crafted musical, and it would have been had a great shot. But I don't think you can beat the Book of Mormon.
So you're saying Book of Mormon, of course, Catch Me If You Can was nominated, as was the Scottsboro Boys, which, as you say, has closed, and Sister Act, which is based on the movie starring Whoopi Goldberg, although the musical does not star Whoopi Goldberg.
No, she is one of the producers, but no, a fabulous young actress named Bettina Miller is playing the main role in that show, and she's also a Tony nominee.
Now, what about Best Drama? You have Good People by David Lindsay Abaire nominated, Jerusalem by Jez Butterworth, The Mother with the Hat, although that does have a much more colorful name, by, I don't even know how to pronounce this person's name.
Even Adley Gurgis.
Oh, thank you very much. And Warhorse by Nick Stafford. Who walks away with it this year for Best Drama?
You know, this is such an interesting category, not only because there are, four incredibly well put together productions, but I think the winner is actually going to be Warhorse, which is this great spectacle with probably, I think most people, even its major fans, would admit probably the least flashy script of the four. But because we have a best play category that really is meant to be best production of a play rather than best script, I think it will take home the Tony. I think if we had changed, in the old days, there was at least one year where this got broken up and there was a best play that went strictly to the author. I think if we were doing that, Good People would probably take home the Tony.
Now, Warhorse is, it's set in World War I, and it features a horse as one of the main characters, and it's, done with puppets.
Yes, and, everybody says they're puppets, and I guess technically they are puppets, but they're really life-size-looking horses that are operated by human actors, and it is so brilliantly done that while watching it, you totally forget that you're watching actors. You really do feel like you're watching a horse.
Yeah, I tell people it's like The Lion King with a good story. It's incredible production, but with a solid story. And it's running in London for years. I think it's going to run here for years. I mean, it's a sold-out hit right now.
Lincoln Center's already extended it. And fortunately, because they have the ability to rent Broadway theaters to fulfill their subscription, because they do have to put on new productions every few months for their subscribers, they can keep it going at the Vivian Beaumont, which is the right theater for it, and just put up other things elsewhere.
And now let's move on to, I think, just two more categories. One is the toughest category to call, I think. It's Best Actor in a Drama. We have Brian Bedford, who directed and stars in The Importance of Being Earnest, Bobby Cannavale in The Mother with the Hat, Joe Mantello making his return to acting some 16 years after Angels in America. He stars in The Normal Heart, but he's best known now as a director. Al Pacino in The Merchant of Venice, certainly one of the best reviewed shows of the season. And Mark Rylance in Jerusalem, who also had a terrific success in a comedy earlier this season in La Bette. I have no idea who's going to win this. Who do you think will?
I would love to see a five-way tie. These are five of the most extraordinary performances I've seen this or any year. That said, I do think the Tony Award will go to Mark Rylance. His work in Jerusalem, where he basically commands stage for three full hours, and just so incredibly becomes this character, Johnny Rooster Byron, in a way that you don't even necessarily feel like it's acting. You just feel like it's transformation. I think will tip in his favor. Plus, as you pointed out, he also did give a really equally almost Tony worthy performance earlier in the season, La Bette. And I think that 1-2 punch will make him the person at the podium.
He's my favorite stage actor alive today. And if I was voting, I would vote for him. But my heart tells me that people might vote for Joe Mantello in a sympathetic, a return to the stage after so many years. He's such a beloved Broadway fixture, and it's a way to acknowledge that show. Somehow I feel like he might sneak in there.
I wouldn't, I would not be totally shocked. I have nothing but 1,000% admiration for Joe's work in The Normal Heart, which is just breathtaking. I was lucky enough to see him do it at the Actors Fund reading last fall, and he blew me away at a reading in the way nobody's ever done at a reading, and then it's an even more fully realized performance at the Golden Theater in this must-see show. And yes, Joe is a beloved Broadway figure. He already does have a Tony for directing, so that could, people are being sentimental. He does have a Tony, admittedly not as an actor. Bobby Cannavale is amazing. I wouldn't totally be shocked if he snuck in. He won the Drama Desk Award. It was considered, an upset, but he's got a lot of partisans as well. That's true. Anything can happen in that category.
Now, over in Best Actress in a Musical, you have Sutton Foster for Anything Goes. She probably is the front runner from what I've been reading. Beth Leavell in Baby It's You, Bettina Miller in Sister Act, and Donna Murphy in The People in the Picture. Who do you think walks away with it in Best Actress in a Musical?
again, a great category with a lot of wonderful people in it. There are, I should note, only four nominees rather than the traditional five, because there were only six eligible women this year, and Tony's little arcane rules, when there are six, there are only four. That said, I do think Sutton Foster is going to take the Tony. People are just enchanted, and rightly so, with her work in Anything Goes. She is the ultimate in what we call the triple threat. She acts brilliantly, she sings unbelievably, and most importantly here, she dances. She leads the tap number of the first X finale, Anything Goes, and it's not a question of star choreography. She is as good, if not a better dancer than the amazing, amazing, amazing Broadway dancers that she's surrounded by in that 5 minutes alone. I think just sort of cast her Tony performance. But that said, they're all great women. Beth Lovell commands the stage in Baby It's You. Donna Murphy is extraordinary in People in the Picture. And Bettina Miller basically, you know, commands the entire stage for all the sister act. It is her first Broadway role, and I think possibly because we know she has many, many to come. Maybe they'll hold off a little while, but it may also be a way to award that show its due. So I won't be totally shocked if Bettina takes it. It's very much the situation like LaShawn's a few years ago in The Color Purple, where she took home the one award for that show.
I think we can look for a steamrolling of Book of Mormon in a lot of the smaller tech categories, and to be crowned the queen of the night.
It has 14 nominations. It won't take home all 14. I don't think it's going to be something like The Producers or Hairspray, where it wins every single award. I actually think Mormon will probably only take home about six. But still, that's nothing to complain about.
No, exactly.
I think it will take on book and score and direction, but I don't know, honestly, that I think it will take home a lot of the so-called tech categories like costume or lighting or set design. I think those are actually going to go to other shows.
Well, we talked about stars, Hollywood stars or movie stars coming to Broadway, but it seems that over the past week or two, I've seen stories where the movies themselves are coming to Broadway. Movies like, of all things, Rocky, the musical, as if we needed this. And Once, which that does make sense. Once is the 2006 Dublin set. It's an independent film, and it starred Glenn Hansard and Marketa Erglova as the two lead characters who are musicians who fall in love, or maybe they don't fall in love.
I think they fall in love. I think they just fall out of love.
Right. And so that I can see becoming a Broadway musical, and it's going to open.
It will open off Broadway this fall at New York Theater Workshop. It was just announced today. There is no firm Broadway plan yet, but that is still their aim.
But now Rocky the musical? I mean, I just was flabbergasted at seeing that.
It's a familiar story. It has certainly some of the elements of traditional musical comedies or musicals, which, you know, very often best revolve around a central love story. I think it's the same thing with Once. A lot of great musicals, really, that's what works best for them. You know, both a story of triumph and obstacle, and also a love story that people can root for. I guess the question is whether or not you think characters like Rocky and Adrian are people who sing, but when you have talented composers like Stephen Flaherty and Lynn Ahrens working on it, I think they can make people sing. They've made people who you don't think sing before. I don't think that anybody would have thought Ragtime was a natural musical, and I think they created one of the greatest musicals of the 20th century with it.
And that's Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty, and it looks as if it's going to open in Germany in the fall of 2012, possibly on Broadway in the spring of 2013, I suppose, if it does well in Germany.
That's a very far out-of-town tryout, but I think, you know, these days, too, and I think it's true of Once, I mean, the cost of putting on a Broadway musical is so overwhelming that to really do a musical cold on Broadway, I mean, Book of Mormon now is, of course, the exception to the rule, since it never technically, you know, it never did an out-of-town tryout, although it did do many years of workshops. I think musicals always tend to benefit when they have been seen by an audience somewhere, and then you can go back and work on them and figure out what you need to change and to modify. And I think you're going to see that pattern more and more. I don't think you're going to see as many shows that come straight to Broadway. I mean, Sister Act, I don't think would have been nearly as successful had it not done London first, where I gather the creative team, Alan Menken and Lane Slater and the book writers, really learned a lot from the London audiences and made some very, very, very significant changes before they came to New York.
So if this year was the perhaps the best year you've ever seen in a season in your 20 years of covering the theater, next year's going to have a lot to measure up to. Is there anything you're especially looking forward to coming up in the summer or the fall or next spring?
Things that have been announced. But that said, we're getting a summer return of Hair. It's the national tour, and I love this production by Diane Paulus. I saw the previous Broadway incarnation, I believe, 4 times and reviewed it. So I'm very excited it's back.
Will that make Godspell feel like also-ran when it debuts?
No, I think, although they certainly are from a similar period in history, they're very different musicals. And, Godspell has not been on Broadway since 1978, I believe. So, I think there's a whole new generation of people who've never seen it, and they'll really be looking forward to, as well as people of a certain age that, may want a chance to revisit.
We've also got Tyne Daly in Masterclass, Frank Langella.
I'm really, really looking forward to. I had a chance to see it actually at the Kennedy Center a little over a year ago. I think it's a wonderful play by Terrence McNally about the opera singer Maria Callas.
It's a great play. It really is a very good play.
I've seen a number of incarnations, and Tyne Daly is really one of our best actresses, and there are a number of other wonderful people. It's a small play. There are only really 5 characters, but there's also Ciara Bagas, who was in The Little Mermaid and Phantom of the Opera, who's really going to get to show off her brilliant operatic voice, and a young singer also with a great operatic voice named Alexandra Silber. I think that's definitely something I'm very excited about.
And are you excited to see Ricky Martin in Evita in the spring?
Yes. I mean, first of all, I'm excited to have another opportunity to see Evita. It's another show that had not actually been on Broadway in about 30 years. I think it's always a great chance to see a musical. And yes, I mean, Ricky Martin, we're all curious to see what he can do as an actor. We know he's a wonderful entertainer. Che Guevara is a fabulous part for any actor. And he is going to be joined by Elena Roger, who did the role of Evita in London, and who I hear was absolutely sensational.
Well, the Tony Awards are this Sunday, June 12th. You can find some of Brian Scott Lipton's work on theatermania.com. Brian, thank you for taking the time to join us to discuss this year's Tony nominees.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, I appreciate Brian Scott Lipton stopping by. I always go to theatermania.com for my theater news, and I'm really looking forward to seeing The Book of Mormon. I've never been more informed about the theater. I've seen almost everything except the biggest show of the year. I was supposed to see it last Friday night, but the lead actor was out sick, and he must have been really sick because it's right before the Tonys. And so I'm going to see it this Friday night. I can't wait. I'll see it Friday, and then the Tonys are Sunday. So I'm really looking forward to it.
So the fact that the lead actor in Book of Mormon was out sick, that was kind of a big deal then.
It's a big deal to me, that's for sure.
And it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story was actually confirmed while we recorded. Katie Couric is coming to ABC. The former CBS news anchor was wooed by all the major networks and CNN, but only ABC was willing to meet one of her two main demands. Couric demanded the networks guarantee their stations would put her on at 4 p.m., and Couric wanted a presence in news as well as her daytime talk show. No one can guarantee an afternoon time slot because of the independence of local stations, and CBS and NBC balked at Couric not devoting herself 24/7 to the talk show and didn't want to keep her in prime time. So ABC swooped in and snagged her by dangling Nightline in 2020 in front of her and her producer Jeff Zucker. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a very big deal. Clearly, the people who launched this fall to try and replace Oprah, some or all of them will fail. That's what happens. So Couric will have a really good chance next fall to launch her show. The possible revenue is anywhere from $100 to $300 million a year from a hit afternoon syndicated talk show like this. She's going to be a part owner. And what I really found fascinating by all the news stories was, she came off CBS News. She hadn't done gangbusters there for a lot of complicated reasons, but she's still a very big, desirable property. Everybody wooed her, and then everybody who didn't get her has been trying to spin the story about how, they didn't really want her in the first place. Her demands were unreasonable. CBS, NBC, CNN, they've all got their explanation for why they didn't want her anyway.
Adele was rolling in the deep. Now she's probably just rolling in a lot of tea and honey. The UK songstress has been conquering the world, but constant touring, not to mention smoking like a chimney, apparently, has taken its toll, and she's come down with laryngitis. Adele had to cancel the rest of her tour and rest those vocal cords. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. It shows the massive stress that you face when you have a breakout album, which this album, 21, really exploded around the world. She's been touring everywhere. She's got a terrific voice, and she's probably been working 24/7. You know, she's been deluged, I'm sure, with, you know, umpteen number of media requests. She could never sleep and never fulfill all the requests she's had. And this is what you do when you have something to deal with, like laryngitis or a medical condition. You have to shut everything down and make sure the one thing that matters most, your voice, is taken care of properly and healed properly before you move on. You have to learn how to say no. And that's really, really hard to do, especially when your success is exploding the way Adele's is.
Well, you know, she was supposed to play here in Los Angeles at the Greek Theater tonight, and I was kind of bummed that I didn't get tickets. And now I'm not so bummed.
But she'll be back. She'll make good those dates. And, you know, nobody wants to hear her sing poorly and with her, you know, or ruin her voice. So, you know, it's the right thing to do.
The X Factor's crazy impasse with its once and future judge, Cheryl Cole, continues. The music competition show dumped the British pop star unexpectedly last week, and we still don't know the official reason why. Cole, meanwhile, continued to apply for a work visa and planned to show up for her job in what amounted to a legal tactic to ensure she got paid a huge amount of money for work she was hired and remained prepared to do. Now we have word that the X Factor will indeed be giving Cole her $1.5 million salary, and insiders say it was just a lack of chemistry that doomed her. Cole's spot on the UK show was already filled in anticipation of her leaving for the US, so she's off the UK's number one show as well. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's kind of crazy. And in fact, even this isn't quite right. I've learned since then that, in fact, the weird thing where they were saying you have to get a visa and show up anyway, even though we fired you, was their attempt to try and embarrass her, according to some people, so that she would quit and they wouldn't have to pay her. They didn't want to pay her the $1.5 million she was, you know, guaranteed. She changed her life around, set up to move to LA, but they didn't want to pay her because they decided they didn't want her anymore. And she was going through with it to say, screw you. I'm not going to quit just because you don't want to pay me $1.5 million. And so they finally caved, the people behind the show, and they're paying her off like they should. And I don't know about the chemistry thing, but it's a sad story all around, I think.
Well, right. And I mean, there was some talk over the weekend that she might be returning as a judge, but I think that was really just...
That was them trying to humiliate her, apparently. That's the latest description I have of that, of trying to give her some belittling role to do, where, you know, make her jump through hoops in hopes that she would quit and they wouldn't have to pay her.
Or that she wouldn't show up for, you know, a scheduled, you know, shoot, in which case, you know, she's in breach
cause.
Breach of contract. So, yeah, and there, you know, she basically said, nope, I'm going to meet every single demand. So,
of course,
better get
it's
that
amazing
pen
that we're discussing so much a show that has never even debuted in the U.S.
I completely agree. TV has a new award show. Thank God the long drought is over and TV can embrace a new award show. The Critics' Choice TV Awards is a competitor to the Emmys that will air on June 22nd on Reels Channel. The nominees for Best Drama and Comedy include 10 shows, making room for newcomers like AMC's The Killing and FX's Archer. Most categories will limit themselves to a modest 6 entries. Is this new award show a big deal or a big whoop, Michael? Can we just like move right on? I mean, do we even need to discuss this award show?
It's a big whoop, a very big whoop, unless they somehow get celebrities to go. But even if they do, who's going to see them on Reels Channel? So, you know, this is a dumb idea, poorly executed, and there you go. I don't imagine it lasting 5 years.
If you went to see X-Men First Class this weekend, you know the movie is set mostly in the early 60s. So was one of the teaser trailers you might have seen. NBC's The Playboy Club was featured in front of X-Men at some chains after launching alongside Bridesmaids in May. TV networks have been pushing their TV shows in theater chains for years. What's new is how quickly they've begun banging the drum to draw the attention of audiences. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's kind of a big deal. I've noticed it myself. As soon as they announce the upfronts and their fall schedule, I've received some fall pilots. And this is, you know, May, June. In the past, I would wait till September or, you know, even October before I'd get some of these. So I'm already getting them really, really early. They want us to see the shows and start talking about them right now because buzz matters. You know, they want people to say, oh my God, Playboy Club looks really sexy.
Yeah, I guess they used to promote them in theaters in June or July, and now they're moving it up to May or June.
Well, this is a slimmed down, sexy, big deal, big whoop, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Well, that's because we talked to Brian Scott Lipton for, well, for what we thought was the necessary amount of time.
Absolutely. Well, covering the Tony Awards, the current season and next season is a lot of stuff to get through.
Right. And now we're going to move along into Inside Baseball, our segment where we discuss the stories that only people in the business might care about. And this week, the business is the business of publishing.
That's right. I found this really interesting, and I hope you will too. They had the Book Expo of America took place while I was away in Europe. I'm sorry I missed it this year. That's where all the publishers come together, and all the bookstore chains, all the indie bookstore people, all the authors, they all have booths and panel discussions and shows, and they all talk about all the coming books for the next season and what people are excited about. And you can get galleys for, you know, hundreds of books and meet authors and get book signings and find out what the hot books are. It's just a really fun thing. And of course, the big dominant story of the Book Expo was the ebook. It's really having a seismic effect on the industry. It's proving really disruptive. And I think it's very similar to what the smartphone has done. If you look at the smartphone, people are now realizing that it's sort of having a big dramatic effect on the sale of wristwatches, because young people have 14 things in their pocket with the time on it. Why do they need a wristwatch? It's affecting the sale of digital music players like the iPod. I used to have an iPod. I don't anymore because I have an iPhone. And it's affecting the sale of cheap cameras. Everybody's phone is a camera, so you don't need a cheap camera anymore. So that's just one way the smartphone has done this. And I think we're seeing this the same thing with ebooks. And here are some examples. Number one, the ebook might replace paperbacks. Does that make any sense to you, Sperling?
Yeah, I can see that.
Right, because paperbacks, their big allure was that they were cheap and portable.
Right.
You know, they're not big, heavy tomes like the hardcover.
And ebooks
they're really
are cheap and portable. So
they're cheap and they're extremely portable. And yet, it's kind of frustrating because as I've started more and more to read ebooks, sometimes I want to buy a book and then I look and they're making me pay more for the ebook than for the sale price. You know, I'm paying a premium for the ebook over the price that's available for a physical edition. It doesn't make any sense to me. Like, they're penalizing me for choosing an ebook, and that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I know people who just, they're always complaining that the ebook they want costs more than the hardback book.
Yeah, it's completely ridiculous. The ebook is also perhaps changing how books are going to be sold country by country. It used to be that you would buy the rights for North America, you'd buy the rights for France, you'd buy the rights for England, you'd buy the rights for Germany, you'd buy the rights for Australia.
Territorial rights, yeah.
And now it's going to be language rights.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, I mean, if you buy the French rights to a book, you have the rights to sell that book in French worldwide. So if you're French and you're living in Canada or France or Africa, there's a huge French-speaking population in Africa, or Switzerland, for example, this one publisher will be selling that book in all those territories. But that's a really big change, isn't it? Because that affects how you release books, when you release books, and where you release books.
Right, and not to mention all of the, you know, ways electronic data goes back and forth.
Right, so the restrictions you have now where, like, if you're trying to buy an ebook in England and they say, oh, no, you know, that's going to have to change. I mean, there are sometimes they try to block you from buying something in one country when you're in another country, right?
That's right. Yes, absolutely. It's the same as true of music.
Yeah. And so that's a big change. The ebook is almost certainly killing the major bookstore chains. We got news this week that Borders got a reprieve against the desires of some of its major creditors. They were granted an extension in trying to rearrange themselves, even though a lot of the people think it's just a matter of time before they go belly up.
Well, now there's some bidders that are kind of pursuing Borders, although I can't imagine why.
Yeah. And so what the ebook is doing, of course, is taking sales away. Now, some of those chains will keep the sales online, you know, like Barnes & Noble. Obviously, they have an online presence. But a lot of the, you know, Borders is going belly up. Barnes & Noble is in trouble. And the other major bookstore chains, well, those are the two main ones, frankly. There
I was going to say, I don't know where you're going.
There's Books A Million, which deals with, you know, remainder and secondhand books. And there's other chains that are much smaller. But basically, even if they lose 10 or 20% of their sales to online digital sales that are won by other people, that's a huge hit to the bottom line.
Absolutely.
And so there literally will not be major bookstore chains in 10 years, anywhere near like we have today.
No, like there aren't Blockbusters today, and much like there aren't Tower Records today.
Yeah, I'm in New York City. I cannot walk out and buy an album, even a top 10 album that's just been released. There's nowhere for me to go. I have to go to like Kmart and hope they have it in stock.
Hey, you know, if you like the Kaiser Chiefs, I know a good way to get their album.
Right. And one really positive change for ebooks, at least as far as consumers are concerned, just like digital music allows small bands to reach a really wide audience easily and simply, ebooks are helping small authors break out and compete with the big boys.
So ebooks are changing the face of the publishing industries. And in other surprising news, the decline of sales of buggy whips due to the horseless carriage.
That's true. Yes, it seems obvious, but it's interesting now. There's going to be more worldwide releases of books, just like there are with movies. When music is, when information is digital, it wants to be free and it wants to be everywhere.
Well, they're charging me $9.99 for an ebook, so it's not that free. We should probably move along into listener email. Michael, do you want to take this email?
Sure. Dear Michael and Sperling, on episode 105, you said that movie studios don't care where or how their movies make money, and that instead all they care about is the bottom line, how much money their flicks rake in as a whole. I was shocked to hear two experts on the entertainment industry say such a thing.
Ooh, thank you very much. Yeah.
Thanks for calling us experts, by the way.
Yeah.
Major studios very much care how, where, when, and why their releases are making money. They spend a lot of effort tracking such information down to a particular screen in a specific movie theater. This helps them plan future releases, marketing campaigns, and home video launches. And remember, just because a film is making money all over the world doesn't mean the studio gets to see any of it. It has been customary to sell the territorial rights to certain films to other distributors. At times, this happens before the film ever goes into production. Though this is highly unlikely to occur on major titles such as Pirates of the Caribbean, I thought you both would have known that since you attend the Cannes Market each year. So yes, a movie studio cares how much a film makes in its sum total, but those numbers get parsed in ways you can't even imagine to gain valuable business intelligence. Love the show and keep up all the other good work you do. Jared Holmes, entertainment accountant from New York City.
And Jared, thank you for writing to us. I knew we were going to get busted for that. We did get a couple of emails pointing out.
Well, what's your response or what's your feeling about that?
Well, I think he's absolutely right. And I'm assuming Jared is a he. Yeah, I think he's absolutely right. I think major studios do care. They're counting every single penny. At the end of the day, 4 or 5 years down the line, they look at it in a more macro way. Did the movie make money for the studio or not? But when they're releasing a film and when they're watching the returns come in week to week, they are definitely looking at very micro issues and trying to figure out ways to maximize the revenue.
Well, I appreciate his email very much. He makes a lot of good points, every one of which is accurate and true. It doesn't contradict what I was saying, or I don't think what you were saying. We were making different points, but I think he helps us, give us a chance to illustrate or illuminate better what we were trying to say. I wasn't saying that it doesn't matter. You know, they don't, of course, they didn't want to know, oh, wow, this movie did really well in Japan, but it did poorly in Brazil. Why is this? Is there something we can fix in the future? Or what does this mean about that local market? Yes, it helps them for campaigning for in the future and for home video launches. And they, of course, want to track the money because they want to make sure they get all their money. That's all absolutely true. I think the macro idea I was trying to get across was that when we talk about the North American box office, we don't go down and say, how did it do in Alabama versus Tennessee? How did it do in Arizona versus Arkansas?
No, because all that money flows back to the same owner.
But it matters, of course. It absolutely matters as far as, well, what happened in that territory? Why did it do so poorly in Mississippi and do so well in you know, Georgia? They do want to know that information. But when you're looking at the North American box office, you get that big number. And we're trying to argue that the worldwide box office matters more than each individual territory. There's information to be learned as no matter how far you dig down. That's very important. And of course, they do that every day. But at the end of the day, if your movie costs $200 million to make and grosses $1 billion, that's a success.
But I see Jared's point. I guess what he's saying
is... And if it underperforms in, say, North America... There's a lesson to be learned from that, but the simple fact is they spent $200 million and grossed $1 billion, and they're very, very happy.
Well, and to Jared's point, I think what he's saying is sometimes when it's the royal we, the media reports that, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean has made $760 million worldwide, that sometimes, and not on Pirates, of course, but sometimes, yes, that's a worldwide figure, but Germany and France are going to a completely different distributor, not going back to the Hollywood studio that initially made the film.
That's true, but that's sort of an accounting detail, not so important to the fans, I think. But everything you said is absolutely true. I've always been a very negative about selling off rights to movies in other countries when you're talking about a major studio release. And you see that even today with a big title. In fact, it can happen with Pirates and something like that because it's such a big gamble, you know, like Titanic or whatever. They want to lay off foreign rights because they're worried about the gamble. To me, it's crazy. If you're willing to spend that money, you want to reap the rewards. And I think more and more you're seeing that they're holding on to worldwide rights because the foreign market is becoming so much more profitable. Usually they don't go territory by territory with something like X-Men or
no, no,
Thor.
Those movies you don't need to do that. It's more more
right.
smaller budgeted, sometimes independent
art films. Yeah,
yeah.
But it's everything you said is absolutely true, Jared, and I appreciate your reminding us that you know. Every territory, every city, every theater matters to the studios, and they can get a lot of information from that. That's fascinating and really useful to them down the road.
Yes, everyone should feel free to correct us. As you can see, it actually generates quite the conversation. Feel free to correct us, to praise us, to, well, just write to us. You can do so dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And please do try and keep your messages brief. A five-minute message, highly unlikely to be played on the podcast. Maybe 30, 45 seconds. Anyway, all of that information, ways to contact us, our Twitter account, which is Showbiz Sandbox, our Facebook fan page, which is facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. All of that can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or the Zoom Marketplace or in your RSS reader. That's also where you'll find links to all of the stories we talked about on today's show, as well as all of our past episodes. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. I'd like to thank Brian Scott Lipton from TheaterMania.com for joining us to talk about the year's Broadway season and the Tony Awards. And Michael, you can be found at MichaelGiltz.com. I can be found at Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.